Hello, world. It's Mike Traverso with the Friends That Code podcast, where I get a chance to showcase some amazing people that I know that just happen to write code for a living. Today's guest is a coworker of mine, dare I also say friend of mine. He graduated from the Colorado School of Mines with a Bachelor's of Science in Computer Science and minored in Statistics. While there, he also pitched on the school's baseball team for 4 years. The man could have his own baseball card, folks. He started his career in software development, interning at one of the country's premier national security and nuclear science labs in New Mexico at Sandia National Labs. Since then, he's been building up his software development resume, developing web, mobile applications, using .NET, Angular, and React. Currently, again, like I said, he's a coworker of mine at a New York-based baseball team, and I'll let him tell you what he does there. Math guru, former college athlete, web and mobile app developer. Today's guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Ben Gilman. Ben, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So I ask all my guests to tell me what they do for a living. So, you know, what do you do for a living, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I almost feel like you already gave my intro for me. I'm a full stack software engineer for some baseball team in the Bronx that wears pinstripes.
Right. I think we could say.
What? You were.
Yeah, we do.
Oh, shoot. Okay. Well, you know, with that, I mostly work on an internal website that, you know, houses reports and stats and metrics for kind of every facet of the team to look through. And I get to have fun doing all that.
Excellent. Excellent. So I mentioned in the intro that you interned at Sandia National Laboratory. So, you know, I was doing a lot of research about Sandia National Laboratory before we started talking today. Did I just make it onto a government list somewhere because I Googled it prior to that?
No, it's fine. In fact, like, so I'm from Albuquerque. That's where I grew up and lived for, you know, a dozen years. So most of everyone has known someone or does something at the labs. It's like the staple, you know, place to work at in the city. So just by saying Sandia Labs, you're not on some list. It's not that secretive. And okay. In fact, I didn't end up working in a classified area because I couldn't get my clearance in time.
Gotcha. Okay. Are you allowed to say what you worked on while you were there?
I can sort of talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I worked in this department that mitigated risk for terrorist attacks. So yeah, think about like if anthrax got dropped in the middle of JFK, how fast can you get people out? How fast is that anthrax going to spread? And then how do you clean up the mess? And so I worked on software that used analytics to and like statistics and all those models to figure out how fast things spread and how fast things die off and what the risk of dying is and stuff. It was pretty intense.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, we could probably use something like that for COVID. You know, about four months ago.
No, exactly. One of the things that I didn't enjoy about that internship was like, man, I wrote all this code. I spent 3 to 4 months working on this thing that will never happen. When is there ever going to be a disease coming through? Like that ever's going to be like, that's never happened. Why are we worrying about this? And then this all came through and I thought back, was like, oh shoot, no, this is it. We're getting ready for this.
Yeah, I mean, that project could have been applied to something like a COVID-19 coming
in.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So that's actually really cool. White coats and goggles while you're there, or?
Some people. So there was two sections. There was like a chemical lab, and then there was like the software lab. And so I was like in the software side, but you'd see people like carrying chemicals in their coats and everything going through the hallways because we shared the same office. And so they had these giant mirrors on the corners so that you wouldn't run into any chemist holding like radioactive stuff in their hands and like drop it.
That's far out.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Okay. Let's get back to baseball, right?
You're good.
Let's get back to baseball. So you're working for the New York. You know, what got you interested in the details or the analytics of the game of baseball?
I mean, well, playing baseball myself, you know, that's always something on your mind. You know, there's not a single baseball player you talk to that doesn't know their own batting average, you know. So just the statistics in themselves are just so ingrained with the game that you just kind of pick it up and you kind of understand it. I've always really liked math and I've always kind of excelled at it. So I had some sort of interest in at the time, I'd say like high school, right? I liked math and I liked science. I was like, you know, I like that. And I never thought in my wildest dreams that I'd end up, you know, working for a baseball team or that it was even an option. But when I was in college, my dad for Christmas gave me the historical baseball abstract just for fun. And so I sat there and read the James book about statistics. And I just would go through every decade, every stat. And I read this 300-page book and that's all about numbers in, you know, a few months. And it was interesting to me. I probably couldn't tell you what Bill James was saying in all that time. Like, I forgot most of it. It's over my head, but it made me interested in it. When I was a junior in college, which was my best year, it's kind of relevant for this reason. I had my stats locked in. It was to the point where I was, let's say I pitched the fourth inning and I got in the fifth inning. I knew how much my ERA had changed from inning to inning because I had already pre-calculated that in my head. And so I would go out there on the mound and I wouldn't be thinking about, oh, I need to get this guy out so he doesn't get the first. I was thinking about, oh, I need to get this guy out or strike him out. So then my strikeout per nine percentage can go up and then I can lead the league in this stat or something like that. So it was really,
that's intense.
It could have made me the best pitcher or the worst pitcher, that I was not trying to get people out because I needed to get them out for the game. I was trying to like get my stats higher.
That's pretty intense. So so for folks listening who don't know about who Bill James is, he's a statistician, and he's behind a field called Sabermetrics, which is kind of the empirical analysis of baseball stats and the in-game activity measurements. So like Ben's talking about how many pitches you're throwing, how many walks, how many strikeouts, every kind of aspect of the game. So did I cover pretty much Sabermetrics in a nutshell?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just really just the collection of data to answer whatever you need to answer.
And so you mentioned kind of how you were kind of locked into some, you know, to having your stats. How do baseball teams use this science to their advantage?
Well, I mean, it depends on the level. I mean, you could have people in college like, hey, this guy's a higher batting average. Let's put him higher in the lineup. You know, that's the very base level. And in that sense, that in itself is sabermetrics. If you really get to the nitty gritty details of what the definition of that is. But, you know, teams like us, you know, we use every number and under the sun that you could think of that you didn't even know we were tracking. Sometimes we don't even know we're tracking it. You know, it gets us matchups, pitcher to batter matchups, figure out, you know, who should be put in the game. People have been talking about the game recently about shifts going out of control because we know what side of the field someone hits at. You know, you can make valuations of who's valuable on your team, who's not, who do you need to trade, who do you need to pick up, when a play is safe to make. So if, you know, is the percentage of stealing better when you have two strikes versus one strike, you know, the stuff like that we can figure out. And these advanced, you know, analytics are what drives every MLB team now. There's not one I can't think of that's not using it to some extent.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, and we're not going to get into how we actually would use it. You know, it sounds like you've got this immense love of the game of baseball, which is very cool. And millions of Americans love baseball, probably, you know, even some of our listeners, right? But to love the game and then find a way to get a job in it doing, you know, the other thing they enjoy doing, which for you, I imagine is coding, writing code.
Yeah.
That's pretty special. How'd you get into working with the Yankees? What was that like?
It's kind of a funny story because of how little of a story there is.
This will be a short podcast. Then,
it's 5 minutes. Oh, it's over. Hey, thanks for having me. I'll start from the beginning. I guess I was never interested in working for a baseball team. I didn't even know it was really an option back in early college, end of high school, until one of my mom's coworkers, his son, became a scout for the Red Sox. And I thought it was the coolest thing. And then ended up with some managerial changes, ended up going to the Cubs. But my mom was like, man, this guy's job is so cool. You need to do that. And I thought to myself, that would be cool being part of this baseball team and just like traveling with them and doing all this stuff and doing analytics or whatever. But, you know, his job wasn't that much analytics. I was like, you know, I could apply. There's no reason I'm qualified for this. So I still didn't really understand that this was even an option. So I got my job out of college, worked there for 4.5 years, had a big reputation throughout the entire company that I was the baseball guy. So much that we used to do minor league like events. Once a year, we all go to minor league. I'd be so excited, and they dropped it. And so I'd made a petition. I made a petition to the company that we had to keep the minor league baseball games going so I could go to that game. So I just had the reputation. So a coworker of mine, his wife is a recruiter. So she sees these jobs coming through all the time. And she sent this job that I'm in now to my coworker. He goes, you know, this is not for me, but oh, I know the guy that would be so interested in this job. And so he sent the link to me. I applied. It was just an online application. Went through the ranks of all the interviews, and I got it. Like, that's the whole story, really. It's just, you could sum it down to, I got a link and I applied.
Well, I think there's a lot to be learned in that story because putting yourself out there and letting your interests know, you know, to be known with your coworkers, you know, and you said you were that baseball guy in the office. Letting folks know what your interests are and not kind of being shy and kind of, you know, burrowing away and just keeping within your own shell. You know, if you would have done that, this opportunity that you kind of wanted would have never presented itself to you, because you would not have been out there communicating with coworkers and kind of just expressing yourself and being you. So there's a lot to be learned from that, and that you can get out there. And if you're shy, kind of slowly get out there and just start kind of talking to your coworkers and letting them know what you're interested in. So that way, when these opportunities come their way, they know how to flow them into you.
That was super well said, Mike. You should start a podcast.
I should. because there's a lot of people who hear, oh, you work for, and I imagine people that work at tech companies, and we're going to get to some of those folks too on the podcast. And when you start to say big names, everybody comes up to you, hey, oh my gosh, how did you get that job? How can I get a job like that? What advice would you give when they're asking for, hey, how do I get a job in professional sports? That's not a pro athlete, obviously.
So right. Yeah. You go to college, get a D1 scholarship. There you go. I guess the first thing I would say is apply for what you want. You know, I talked about, you know, I'll try to be a scout one day, which I never end up doing, but it didn't really interest me. So why even apply to a job that doesn't interest you just because it's got the brand name in it?
Right.
So I guess it'd be the first advice is, like, don't waste your time just applying to every single job under the sun because it has New York Yankees on it, or it has Chicago Cubs on it, or what have you. There was a blog, I think, in The Athletic a few months ago that all the GMs came together and did some advice of how to apply to a professional sports team. And like literally every answer was just like, good luck. It was fingers crossed, good luck. But there are ways to make yourself stand out. We've been part of interview processes in our own departments here. And the thing that makes anyone stand out is just the passion for the job that they're applying to.
That's very well said. I mean, so let's, you know, that passion, right? If you find that job, I mean, you're looking for it. And I think one of the best places to look for jobs, especially in baseball, would be a site called FanGraphs. Teams typically don't put out jobs on, say, a Stack Overflow. So if you're in technology and you want to get a job in sports to leverage your technology skills, teams will typically put jobs over in FanGraphs and not necessarily Stack Overflow, right? Because that's just kind of where they live and where that experience they're looking for. But when you mention passion, you know, going into that interview and knowing as much as you can about where you're at, who you're talking to, huge, huge thing.
Oh yeah.
I mean, to go in, and it's funny because, you know, you interview people and you say, hey, do you have any questions? And when someone comes back and says, no, I have no questions, it indicates that maybe they're not as passionate about the job as you would like them to be, but coming in and doing research, knowing about where you're interviewing, huge, huge upside to that. So do the research before you go on that job search.
Yeah. I mean, that applies to any company.
Yeah.
I interviewed at Microsoft a few times, trying to get a job out of college, and my interviews went okay. The technical questions, I think I got mostly right, but mm-hmm. I never got the second interview because they would always have like, oh, what part of Microsoft are you really passionate about? And I would like, I don't know. I like video games. So put me in Xbox. Like, you know, like that's the answer you would get. I had close friends of mine that got that job because they lived and breathed Microsoft, and that's what right. they did, you know?
Yeah. So it's a good piece of advice is to be passionate about where you're looking to be. And then obviously don't waste your time, right? Because if you're not passionate about working there, you'll get the job. And then what, you know, two weeks after you're told you've got the job and you have to show up, you know, now you're stuck working somewhere where you're not as passionate and you don't want to be necessarily. So,
yeah,
you know, careful what you're wishing for there.
I guess that's really true.
So you're early on in your career in technology at this point in time. And I hate asking this next question because it feels so job interviewee, right? But looking forward 5 years from now, 10, you know, what do you wishing to be doing in the next 5 years from now?
Yeah. So my close friends would tell me that my biggest weaknesses are, that's good. So, I mean, really with the answer to your question, I would like my goal, my career is to stick with baseball. Talking about this passion thing. I mean, it's one of those, I worked in consulting right before this. Mm-hmm. In consulting, you would jump, you know, client to client to client, not necessarily knowing even what the business is. I had to learn 3 separate businesses in healthcare, in transportation, and in food. Wow. That I knew nothing about, but they throw you in there to the wolves, like, okay, fix these people's problems. So, okay, cool. But when I got here, I was like, well, I know exactly what baseball is. I care about it enough that I could, when going to work isn't a chore for me. Right. So, you know, I just think that sticking to a job where I know that I love what I do is exactly what I should be doing. Okay. So the answer to where I see myself, you know, 5-10 years from now is doing the same thing. That being said, will it necessarily be for the NBA? No, not necessarily. Well, but you know, MLB, just MLB. I would want to move up at some point. I'm not, you know, content with just staying where I am. So, you know, getting promoted to some sense, I don't see myself being a GM anytime soon or why I want to be.
Right.
But no, I think that'd be really cool. Just to move to the ranks, potentially actually live in the city that I work in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, to that point, I'll just mention, so we're both able to work remotely. So yeah. I'm in Florida and Ben is in Texas. It's kind of cool that we're able to you know, work on the same team together. We're working on a project today and we're able to talk to each other. We've been in the same room, I think twice, different types of times. So it's a cool way to kind of work, but you know, I just wanted to point that out. When you say being in the same city, being able to go into a ballpark every day, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we talked, and you kind of mentioned before you were a pitcher in high school and also in college. I won't give any away your stats away.
Well, they're nothing special.
Well, so I want to talk about failure, right? Because baseball is a game of failure. You know, for example, right? You know, just an example. You have the best hitters in baseball, and they get up to the plate and they're successful, you know, 30% of the time, right? So, I mean, in many ways, like software development is also a career of failing. You know, we've got bugs, or, you know, I like to call them unintended features, if you will. And everybody has them in their code, nobody's out there writing code without bugs. There was, you know, when I went to school, software engineering, they taught you the biggest bulk of any project is the project maintenance because of bugs and features and, you know, any, all that other fixing of things that weren't, you know, rolled out. So how do you deal with failure?
Well, you know, growing up in baseball, as you said, I got used to failure pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it really just, you're going to fail 100% of the time. Like, you're, like, any job you're in, you're going to fail at least once. Whether that's on the smallest level, like writing a code locally, when you don't even, you know, commit it to a branch or deploy it out, that's still failing. You're still failing to some extent. So you just got to learn to accept failure and learn from your mistakes the best way you can.
Yeah. Well said.
From the baseball perspective, if I was to throw a fastball down the middle to the number four hitter and he hits a home run, well, I'd learn not to do that next time.
That's a good example. I mean, you know, just kind of taking it back to software. I mean, you know, just to, for folks out there listening, you know, especially if you're young in your career or even if you've been established for a while, mistakes happen. And I think depending on who your boss is, I mean, because there are bad bosses out there who aren't as well mannered and would take an issue that you have and use it as a teaching moment, right? But you have to know in your head that you have to learn that any mistake you make is a teaching moment, because if you make a mistake, that's, you know, acceptable. But if you make the same mistake, it's a different story, right? If you continuously make the same mistake. So learning from how you made that mistake and trying to not do that again, it's a learning thing. And one other little bit of advice is that if you're really interested in kind of getting out there and really, you know, moving things forward in you know, your career, one thing to do is to write a blog about how you've either made a mistake or how you fix something. Like if you come across a bug or you've come across a feature that you've introduced and something was broken or some feature didn't work and you fixed it, writing up a blog article on how you dealt with that be incredibly important, not just for other people to read, but for yourself to be able to go back later and read. So this way, you know, you don't make that same mistake again. I've written a blog, you know, a while back, I wrote a blog article for an Android recycler view, just a table, you know, that allows you to kind of scroll back and forth. And constantly I go back and reread that because, you know, I solved it once. I'm not going to go through and re-implement something by reading documentation or, you know, rereading Stack Overflow issues. So little things like that. Okay.
I mean, I would double down on that blog, right? We talked about, you know, what makes you stand out in an interview. If you can go to interview and present a blog or your own personal website that you might have failed on to the people who are interviewing you and say, here, look, this is how I think, this is how I code, and here's, you know, how the responsibility I am for my failures. I mean, that'll make you stand out just on its own.
Yeah. And you know, hopefully having the blog where you can show off how you code kind of gets you maybe past the whiteboard bubble sort. I don't know if they still do that.
Oh man, I've had to do my share of technical interviews like that. It's not fun. It's just so impractical. Like you don't use any of the stuff that you talk about.
I've failed at one of those at Apple, and I failed spectacularly.
Oh really? I need to hear this.
Oh, it was bad. I mean, so all right. The HR folks said, "Listen, just dress comfortably." And, you know, I've been in interviews before where like people have put out cookies and brownies and sodas. And if they caught you like taking, you know, any of those, they, like, boom, you're out.
Wow.
That's a ding.
Brutal.
Yeah. So I've been through those kind of interviews before. And so naturally I'm like, oh, I hear that. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, sure. Whatever. Suit and tie. Here I come. And, you know, you get out to Cupertino and you're doing the interview and you're realizing nobody else is in a suit and tie. Everybody else is in jeans and t-shirts and whatnot. And, you know, you get there and we were in a small room with little air conditioning, and there were usually, you know, anywhere between three and, you know, two people in there. So it was very hot. I'm sweating profusely and trying to work through problems. And it was just, you know, cause the whole thing with the, like an Apple or a Microsoft interview is they're trying to see how well you problem solve. It's all about thinking through a problem, not necessarily coming up with the right answer, but thinking through it. And my brain just said, nope, we're not doing this.
Yeah. I was never really part of interviews. I think my old company used to do the, why is a manhole cover round? And you had to talk through that, or how many golf balls can fit in this room? You know, yeah. Things like that.
There's a really great book out there, and I'll put it in the show notes. It's called Cracking the Coding Interview. Really great book. I've mentioned it before, so I'm going to put that again back in the show notes to for folks who are interested. And I believe there's an Audible version of it. I haven't checked that out yet. I'm going to check that out for the next podcast to, just to check, see what that's like. Because it is a big book, but I'm not sure how an Audible book would cover coding problems. That would be interesting. All right, moving on. Ben, what's your favorite technology stack to work with?
My favorite language is C#.
Oh, okay.
It has been since my internship at Sandia Labs, which actually introduced me to C# because I never used it once in college. And I just fell in love with it. I actually was developing a Windows mobile app.
And, oh, boy.
Yeah.
Xamarin?
Yeah, no, that was before Xamarin.
This
was native Windows mobile, like a Windows phone.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. And that was all C#. I was like, man, this language is great. Why was I using that in Java this whole time? So anything C#, .NET Core, which uses C# is probably super easy to pick up. You can do almost anything you want with it. It being open source now, I can develop it on a Mac or Windows. Yeah. And then my second thing would be, I guess, like insert new JavaScript framework here. Yeah. There's always a new one. I know React very well. I'm very familiar with it. I think is pretty good work in it. But all my former colleagues and so many of my friends are like, no, why are you on React? You got to be in Vue. Why aren't you using Vue? Vue's the new thing.
Right.
Like, yeah, can't wait till whatever next framework comes out in a year or so and everyone jumps on that train. It's like a new chat client of the JavaScript world.
Well, so that, I mean, that's the thing though. It's, you know, when a lot of folks go to conferences and it's just that, I think it's the interaction from folks going to all these developer conferences, and out of that comes ideas for new frameworks to solve existing problems. So it's a fun thing to have all of those kind of toys in your tool chest to be able to play with. So
yeah, it's really interesting just taking, you know, what's fundamentally a language like JavaScript, which in itself is just complete garbage, all things considered, really. It's one of the worst languages, yet it's so widely used because people were able to develop these ridiculously effective frameworks around this terrible language and just make it way more usable than it ever was.
Right. You know, speaking of that, Google has, you know, just a plug for Google. So I don't get paid from Google or anything like that. But Google has Dart, which is a JavaScript-like language. And they've based their Flutter framework on it, their ad, all the stuff that goes through their advertising modules is written on Dart. So if you don't like JavaScript and you want to keep doing web stuff, there's Dart. So you can check that out as well. And I think it's dartlang.org. And if you're interested in doing stuff with on mobile, you can use it with Flutter, and you can go to, I think it's flutter.org, or I'll put it in the show notes. I have no idea. Okay. So talk about favorite technology stack. Are there any folks out there in the technology world that you're a big fan of?
Yeah. Oh man, you already know the answer to this question too.
I do.
Well, we're already talking about frameworks, and you know who is the pioneer of the JavaScript framework world is freaking John Papa. The guy's the man.
Okay.
I don't have any, like, you know, celebrity envy crush except for this guy right here.
But I've met John a couple of times, and we've gotten him to come out to DevFest Florida at least once. I think it was 2017. So I'm going to try to see if I can't, you know, at least get you an introduction to John. He's a very nice guy.
I think I'd be forever indebted. But no, which is what makes him so awesome, is he's not this huge guy. He's not this huge personality. I my answer wasn't Mark Zuckerberg. You know.
Oh. We would cut this off right now.
Yes. Interview's over. Everything you say is invalid. So here's this guy, right? Where let's cut back 2014. Here's this guy that was just doing his job at Disney. I think he was at Disney. And here's his open source same framework that I'll go back. I don't want to say just this guy. I think he was like a principal architect with Disney and has been in the industry for 25 years and knows exactly what he's doing and everything he's doing. He's teaching on Pluralsight. He's doing all this stuff. So there's this framework in disarray, Angular, that is super popular, but no one's writing it correctly. Everyone's doing it super inefficient. It's crashing browsers. So John Papa just comes up and says, you know what? I'm teaching Angular in a course. Why don't I actually write the definitive style guide for Angular so that everyone writes efficient code that's readable? And so he just did this on his own. I don't think he intended it to blow up the way it did. And then it just became the de facto, like, this is how you write Angular. So you just had this someone who's super passionate about what he's doing, wants to make the world better, and then it just succeeds. And he becomes the face of this language, which he didn't even write. He's speaking at conferences about Angular, and everyone's looking to him, including myself, about like, oh man, this guy knows everything he to do about this language. Like, and he wrote the Angular 2 stuff too. And he's just been with this framework that he just was super passionate about. And so I think that's what really encapsulated me about John Papa, is he just took something that he's like, oh, it's a good idea, and he just put it out in the world and everyone loved it.
Cool. I mean, that's it. It's, well, again, I'll reiterate that, you know, I've met John and he is a very nice guy. So I'm going to try to see if we can't facilitate like some kind of an email exchange, at least between you guys. But to your point about just doing it, you know, I was talking to someone the other day and it was Keisha Williams, and she had this great bit of advice, which was, don't ask for approval, just do it. And in your, like, when you talk about the story with John, he just did it. Didn't ask for anybody for the approval to do it, just did it. So, you know, to some extent, you know, take the initiative, you know, get out there, do something. And it doesn't have to be some major thing where you're writing a huge style guide for a framework, but, you know, just do something and see where it gets you. Obviously try to do things that are good, that will have a positive impact. You know, we don't want to encourage any kind of negative activity, but go out there and do some positive things and, you know, just see what happens, see where it gets you. Most of the time when you're doing something positive that has a positive impact on other people, you're going to get a lot of people, you know, appreciating what you've done. Don't worry so much about getting yelled at for doing something. Ben, I want to ask you real quick, hardest thing to do.
Okay.
Add speed to a fastball or learn a new aspect of coding, whether it's a framework or whatever, what have you.
Oh, throwing a change up at me. honestly, it's probably about the same. And here's why.
Okay.
Right. Because fundamentally, if you don't know how to throw a fastball, when you first learn how to throw a fastball, you're going to go from 30 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour in a day.
Okay.
Yeah. And so almost the same thing with coding, right? If you don't really know how to do this, run this language, you can do the intro to, you know, C#. I'm like, oh, I understand the fundamentals of C# and you can do coding. But you get to a certain point, you talk about an MLB player and they've been throwing fastballs for 30 years. And say, hey, can you get a little more velocity on this? Like, do you know how much I've been working? You know, like how am I going to learn any more of my mechanics to make this ball go faster? And I almost feel like the same way with coding. If you've been writing the same language every single day and you've only been working on the same stuff every day, well, there's not much to learn. You know, so I guess you plateau. Really, it's about the same. Because once you get to a point, it really takes that extra step, that extra thing. Right now, we're working with spin data and all this extra stuff, mechanics and slow-mo video, which a lot of other teams are doing.
Well, I really want to focus though on what you just said there and the plateauing. when we talk about, you know, getting to that point where it's like, I've been doing this for a long time. I don't have anything else to learn. In a Major League Baseball or in Minor League Baseball, pitchers will end up learning a new pitch.
Right.
And it necessarily won't necessarily be a fastball, but it'll be something else. And I think when you feel that way in software development, you need to learn something else.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a new framework. Maybe it's a new way of, you know, writing a new arc, you know, creating a new architecture around what you've got in your code. Maybe it's learning, you know, how to write test cases, how to write UI test cases, learning Git, getting into the weeds with Git or something like that. Anything, learn something else so that you don't stay stale. Because in this business, when you stay stale, you tend to kind of resent where you're at, and that's not good. And usually learning stuff is a lot of fun anyway, right? One of the great ways to find a place to learn is meetups. There's a lot of meetups around towns and in cities. They have a lot of different things that you can learn, whether it's Java development, C# development, mobile development, Android development, iOS development, whatever it is, machine learning. Find something else to learn and don't let that plateau kind of get you down. But I think, Ben, I want to get back to you. I mean, so when we talk about fastballs, and you're a pitcher, how fast were you going at your fastest?
Oh, well, so that's the thing, is my coach was very much on the baseball player is a baseball player type thing. So we never looked at stats. We never looked at pitch velocities.
Really? Wow.
That has changed since I've left.
So you just imagine, like, so you're just going to say like maybe 90?
Yeah, but it's like maybe 90. I was never clocked. We didn't have anyone clocking. I don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, legitimately, I just was never clocked in college. I threw high 80s in high school. I grew some strength wise and everything, and I fixed my mechanics. Okay. So maybe I hit 91, 92. I legitimately don't know.
That's pretty cool. That is pretty cool.
You would think that the nerdy engineering college would have all the stats, which they do now. There's actually a Mines Analytics Club, Sports Analytics Club at Mines right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so they're so into it. So they have these guys that are just on their free time, just going down to the baseball field and like being, I guess, managers for the team and doing advanced analytics. They're not on the team. They're just doing it for fun.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You mentioned their analytics. You know, because we talked about the analytics and kind of how you feel, how you find it really interesting. If you could spend more time working on the analytics part, say on the machine learning, on a machine learning application, you know, what would it be? If you could spend time learning machine learning, what would your project be?
We're about to come full circle on this one, because I actually did develop a machine learning thing for baseball. That was my passion project.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I said, hey, we have all these analytics. We have all these stats. Let's lock down a pitcher and get into his head. And we can tell ahead of time, pitch to pitch, what pitch is this pitcher going to throw? We could utilize this whatever we want. I'm not condoning cheating or saying that we were going to do it that way. But I was just like, it has to be possible. Machines have to be smart enough to replicate, you know, even the smallest thing between a 1 in 4 chance. What pitch is he going to throw? And so, me and a coworker worked on this for about a month, a couple hours, like almost every day. At least I was working on it like crazy, and it failed completely. It didn't work like at all. Spent hours and hours. I even thought to myself, you know, I am a pitcher. I know inside the pitcher's heads better than the pitchers know inside the pitcher's heads. Yeah. You know, I brought this cocky attitude. It was thinking about all these different scenarios that someone's thinking of, and I've put these all in the algorithm. It just failed. And so, but I learned a lot from it. I learned, I guess, machine learning in general.
Yeah.
I learned how to code all that. I learned that computers can't think like a human does. Even if you have, 100 million pitches of data to go through.
Yeah.
And,
what I always think is funny about the machine learning stuff is because I've played around with Amazon Deep Composer.
Okay.
So Deep Composer is something where you can kind of provide a melody and then give, you know, Amazon some instruments, and then it'll create a whole song for you. You know, and it
Wow.
it's terrible on the first pass. I mean, it really is. And you really have to know kind of how to tweak things. And I mean, eventually playing around with it, you will get a better output. But like you said, I mean, it failed miserably on, you know, for your attempt. And I imagine you probably didn't have a whole lot of time to kind of dedicate to something like that.
No, but I mean, if I were to dedicate any more time, it just would have gotten, it would have went from suck to stink.
Okay. Well, so, but that's kind of my point is, you know, it's, you think about a human being, right? And like children learn, and it takes them a number of years before they're able to learn different behaviors, right? Behave, eat, here's how to eat. All these little tiny things. Here's how to walk. Here's how to talk. Mm-hmm. All these little things. And when we sit down with machine learning, we'll sit down with a tutorial and, you know, with some output, some, you know, sample data input, we'll be like, oh, this doesn't work the way I wanted it to. Like, well, you just get your, or it's not fast enough. And it's like, you've just given a machine, you know, 10 seconds or a minute and a half, you know, give it some time to learn. And you'll have a little bit better experience with it. But
yeah, machine learning is tricky. I have a former coworker of mine who's been, once I left the project I was on, they implemented like this ultimate score so that they could essentially rank the decisions that are made by all their employees. And They have three guys working on it, 40 plus hours a week, one of which has a PhD, and they've been working on it every single day for the last year and a half, and I still don't think it's ready.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so I want to move away from machine learning. I want to get into some retrospective bits of advice that you can give. So are you ready?
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. What would be some advice that you'd give your younger self now that you've had all of your career experiences?
Oh, because I've had so much career experience in the 6 years since I've been out of college.
Well, I mean, you've had, but that's the thing though. You've obviously grown. I mean, it's been 6 years since you've started. So what would be some advice that you'd give your younger self?
Maybe I tell myself, you know, not to settle. I think when I first got out of college, we talked about this earlier, but I mean, I was in a job where I didn't really have a passion for it. You know, I woke up every day. I was like, oh, I can't wait to get out this client. So maybe next time I'm on a client that I really care about. And the coworkers I had definitely made up for a lot of that. But at the end of the day, you got to be passionate about what you're doing. So my life right now is so much different than it was before, just because I actually enjoy going to work on a daily basis, not just on a semi-daily basis.
Right.
Even if I know it's going to be a crazy day.
Yeah.
So I would just tell myself, you know, not to settle.
That's good advice.
Yeah. You know, kind of with that, you know, make relationships at work, because you know, they'll get you through the bad days and help you through the good days too. And, but I guess, you know, your work friends are your work friends, and you should definitely make friends outside of work too. And just don't count on work being your only social function.
Good. That's good advice. That right there is good advice. You know, don't get too holed up in the job.
Yeah. So those would be good, I guess, what I would tell myself.
All right, we're good. That's good. What's some advice you think that maybe your older self would give to you now?
Oh,
this is a little bit of a mind bender.
Yeah.
Time travel.
So one thing that I already know, that I struggle with is, getting caught up on like awards and accolades, you know, let's talk to my younger self almost too, but also my current self is, you know, pushing toward that promotion. Well, once you get that promotion, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, you might be making a little bit more, but your job's the same. You're doing the same thing. I mean, so don't put so much emphasis on promotions or awards or recognitions. Just do your job on a daily basis. In the same way, like for me, I even struggle with it now where, you know, working for a baseball team, what's the ultimate goal of the baseball team? It's the Winter World Series. And so, you know, we're in the middle of the season. I'm sometimes thinking about, oh, where's this going to put us in the playoff spot? And so ingrained in this whole thing that I get distracted on my own work, and it, you know, makes me fail a little bit. Fail more than I'm already failing. We talked about this. Everyone fails.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's great advice. I mean, I worked for Morgan Stanley for a number of years, and I was really gunning for that VP promotion. And I was getting fantastic bonuses and raises up until the year I got the VP promotion. So instead of giving me, you know, the money that I was thinking I was going to get, I just got a box of business cards with a different title.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not always what you're expecting. So don't focus on that stuff. Focus on being happy. I mean, that's what this podcast is about. It's really trying to inspire some happiness and you know, help folks out. Okay. So, you know, we talked about being really kind of nerdy stuff here. You know, programming nerds, math nerdy stuff. What is one thing that you do that totally breaks the mold on being a programming nerd that you're willing to share?
Oh, so
is it something like golf, riding bikes, skydiving? Do you just a huge fan of Downton Abbey?
Well, I mean, I can't use baseball because that's a cop out.
Yeah, can't use baseball.
I feel like golf goes in that same thing. Although I do go golfing occasionally. I went golfing twice last weekend.
Okay,
but I'm like this huge movie buff.
Okay. It's
probably the biggest thing. I actually have like one of those movie subscriptions that you can go to the movie theater every single week and like watch a movie for free.
Very cool.
And I would go at least once a week back when, you know, movie theaters were open. But we're not talking about that.
You and I have a very similar taste when it comes to baseball movies, I think, too.
Yeah, our coworkers do not.
For another time, I think.
Yeah, for another time, another podcast. but I, you know, well, the one thing about me is, well, I guess one, I very diverse. So I'm saying like, you know, I love movies or whatever. I also am like super into Broadway. My wife and I both are.
Okay.
So we're actually doing a Broadway live quiz tonight that we had to pay for to get into.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
When I lived in New York, I used to go to a lot of shows, because the bar I used to go to was right there. So I loved it. And I think since Hamilton's been out on Disney Plus, I think we've seen it, my wife and I, have fought 4 or 5 times.
Nice.
And it's only been out for 2 weeks. Yeah.
I mean, there's just some days where I get through the day listening, like the Broadway shuffle on Google Music. And like I'll just go hop musical and musical while I'm coding. So that is like one thing that most people don't know about me, which I'm not ashamed about. It's just a little quirk of mine.
It doesn't really come up in conversation, but I got to tell you, Ben, that answer right there has totally brightened up my day. So thank you. I appreciate that.
My wife's way more into it than I am.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you share hobbies. That's okay. All right. I have some other questions for that, but we're running out of time. So we'll come back to that after.
All right.
We'll have a conversation about Sounds that.
Good. It's for the post show.
Yeah.
Sponsors only.
So I want to move on. So we want the podcast to be all about positivity. And I think we do a good job with that. And if we don't, please leave me a comment. I'd love to hear how we can be better. Being positive, I mean, it means that you're going to need to love yourself before you're able to show love to other developers, other people in the community, or as I like to call it, the tribe, this wacky tribe of software developers. Tell us about one or some of your accomplishments that you're most proud of, that when times get tough and you've had a failure, that you can dig deep into that, you know, accomplishment well, and, you know, say, hey, I did that thing, so I can totally do this. I can get through this. So what is one or some of those accomplishments that you fall back on to get you through the hard times?
Well, I'll give the, while corny, completely accurate answer that just the life I have my wife and the fact that we're married makes me so happy every day. I'm very blessed to be with her and have the life that we have.
That's an excellent answer. She's not in the room, right, with you?
She's not. No, she can't hear any of this. So that's number one. I guess number two is I'm still really proud of the things that I did at school in terms of baseball and what I was able to manage to do with baseball and school at the same time. In fact, I have an award. I got the Presidential Senior Scholar Athlete Award at Mines. And so I had that displayed at all times in my office, just to kind of remind me that, you know, I could work hard on multiple, you know, like just not in the classroom, but, you know, outside of it as well. So that I'm so super proud about that. But you know, I sometimes think back to just like coding, right? Back to my first triumph that I had at my job. I was just this, I say little kid, but you know, kind of just new kid out of college at my first job. And I got this assigned this project that I had never done before. I never knew the technologies were. They told me, hey, we have this thing that's going on. We need you to convert all this paper forms to electronic forms. And it needs to be automatically generated so that no one has to write any paperwork anymore. And that was like all they gave me. So I spent about me, just like right fresh out of college, spent 2 months working on this PDF generator that took all this input form data that everyone else was developing and compiled it into printable, sendable, and faxable PDF printouts to use for health insurance is really what it's for. And like, I crushed it. You know, I feel like I'm a mostly humble guy, but like, I'm looking back, I crushed that thing. So me as, you know, 21 year old Ben, fresh out of college, completely changed this company's like workflow, and everything they were working toward worked because I got over the finish line. And so I'm still super proud of that. Just to know that I was able to take something I knew nothing about in an industry I knew nothing about, in technology I knew nothing about, and finish it and get over the finish line. So I'm still super proud about that.
That's excellent. That's and I mean, that's, again, that's what this podcast is about, is that when you're having those tough times, you're able to focus in on, even if it's a small accomplishment, whatever it is, to get you through those tough times, so that you don't feel like, you know, you don't belong, or you can't do something, because you can. All right. Thank you so much, Ben,
for having me,
for joining me today. This was a lot of fun. I hope you had some fun.
Yeah.
Hanging out today. All right, cool. All right. So thanks again, Ben. Thank you all for listening. Next week, we'll be back with another amazing person that I know that just happens to write code for a living. Until then, be well, everyone.